From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the Rolling Stone who doesn't move around on stage, and he says never really indulged in drugs. Bass player Bill Wyman has written a new book about his first decade with the Rolling Stones. Also, a talk with novelist Michael Cunningham. His new novel, A Home at the End of the World, is about sexual identity and a non-traditional family. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Canadian singer-songwriters Kate and Anna McGarrigle. And Stephen Schiff reviews Robert Altman's new film, Vincent and Theo, about painter Vincent van Gogh and his brother. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. Marines began a landing exercise today on a Saudi Arabian beach believed to be near the Kuwaiti border. The Pentagon said the training involved 16 ships, about 1,000 Marines, and 1,100 aircraft. The exercise, codenamed Imminent Thunder, is set to continue for 6 days. The Defense Department also said that Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine units will conduct joint amphibious warfare training with the Saudi military. Iraq has called the exercise a provocative act because it's being held close to occupied Kuwait. Egypt and Syria say there won't be an Arab summit on the Gulf crisis and blame Iraq for ruining the chances for one. Larry James reports from Cairo.
A statement issued in Damascus after 2 days of talks between visiting Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad said Iraqi preconditions had made an Arab summit difficult, if not impossible. The two leaders said Baghdad's insistence on keeping Kuwait ruled out holding a meeting, as proposed by Morocco's King Hassan. The joint statement followed several days of intense diplomatic activity, which followed the Moroccan proposal. Statements yesterday by Saudi and Iraqi officials had already cast doubt over the likelihood of an Arab summit. Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal said no Arab summit would be possible until Iraq abided by Arab League and UN resolutions calling on it to withdraw from Kuwait. And Iraq's deputy prime minister said his government wanted Arab leaders to rescind their resolutions calling for an Iraqi pullout. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
The leader of the nation's Roman Catholic bishops today sent a letter to President Bush warning of the moral dangers of a possible war in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Pas Cohen reports.
The letter says that offensive military action by U.S. troops at this time could violate the church's moral criteria for use of military force. Archbishop Daniel Pilarczyk of Cincinnati, president of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, says his fellow bishops in their just-completed meeting urged him to write in response to the latest buildup of U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf.
There are some moral issues involved, and we just want to be sure, Mr. President, that you are concerned with those moral issues.
The letter, hand-delivered to the White House this morning, goes further than one sent by the bishops last week to Secretary of State James Baker. I'm Pas Cohen in Washington.
The FBI said today that it's obtained cable news network tapes and is reviewing them to see if they're recordings of prison phone calls made by deposed Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega. The network says the tapes were obtained without a warrant and is demanding their return. The FBI says the tapes were found in a hotel lost and found department. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 15 points today to close at 2,545. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. They're known as the world's greatest rock and roll band, and whether or not you think their music is still worthy of the title, there's no denying the importance of the Rolling Stones. They've been recording since 1963, and their longevity is unprecedented. Bassist Bill Wyman is the member of the band that calls the least attention to himself on stage, and offstage he's had the reputation as the Quiet Stone. But now he's written a biography of the band called Stone Alone. The book takes the Stone story through the 1960s. In 1964, the Stones had their first single on the U.S. charts. It was Tell Me.
I want you back again. I want your love again. I know.
What have you done to keep track and to remember what has happened over the years?
Well, I've been writing diaries since I was a child, and unfortunately, when I did my military service, being the only one that did in the Stones, my mother threw all my old diaries away when I was a little boy, so I was a bit disappointed about that. But I kept a diary ever since then, like from before I joined the Stones, right the way through to the present day, which is very valuable.
Do you ever feel that you're the only one of the Stones with enough of a memory to keep everything straight because you were straight?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Keith Richard does have quite a good memory, actually, believe it or not. The others aren't very good at memorizing anything.
In your book, you write that you've stayed away from drugs over the year, apart from some pill popping and occasional joints in the mid-60s. Why did you always steer clear of drugs?
I just like reality. I quite enjoy my life as it is and what's happening, my private life as well, and I've never really thought I needed that sort of escapism. And drugs, you know, drugs are such a problem. They're a problem to get access to them, as I've seen from other people, and they just cause so many problems within yourself and your personal friends and family and things like that. And I was always feeling very responsible, particularly for bringing my child up since I was divorced from the ages of about 4 on my own. And I always felt very responsible to go back to him and be a normal father if I could, which was saying something in this band.
Brian had once described you as the Rolling Stone that nobody ever knew. Did you see yourself as different from the rest of the Stones in any way?
Well, I was, for the same reasons. I felt responsible to go home after shows instead of hanging out in clubs at night. I do the reverse now, probably, because my son's grown up. But and Charlie did as well. You see, he got married in 64. So we were both married and stable, and we would go back to our families after concerts and after a day's work, whereas the others would just hang out with friends and get up to all kinds of mischiefs.
And now?
Oh, it's the other way around now. I think they all stay at home with their friends and I get up to all the mischief.
Bill Wyman is my guest, Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, and his new book is called Stone Alone. How did you first meet up with the Rolling Stones, with the other members of the band, and start playing with them?
I had a band in South London, which I'd been playing in for about 2 years. It was my band. And my drummer answered an ad for a drummer for a small blues group in London called the Rolling Stones. That's R-O-L-L-I-N, Stones, which was an assortment of musicians that got together and actually played 2 or maybe 3 very small gigs per month in the period of mid-62 to the end of 62. And he filled the drum chair. It was always vacant. There were always people coming and going. It was Brian and Ian Stewart, the keyboard player, who formed the band, started it, and Mick and Keith later joined with a few other people, and people came and went. And he joined the band, my drummer, and played on and off with them for about 4 or 5 months, probably 10 or 12 shows or something, for very small jazz things and that. There was no other places to play in those days. And one day he came to me at the end of November or early December 62 and said, look, they don't have a bass player. Why don't you come up and come to a rehearsal? So I went up there and met everybody. That's the way it happened.
You didn't like the blues as much as the other members of the group?
There's nothing to do with liking. I'd never heard it. In those days, blues was not played in on the radio. There were no records to buy that had blues in them. They were all American. They were all imports. And they were collected by mainly jazz people who sent away for records. And as I did for records like Chuck Berry and people like that, I would write to America for them because they were not released in England. Mick had done it, which I was not aware of at the time. He'd done it about the same time as I had, writing off to America for records. There was no availability for that kind of music unless you knew various students of jazz and people that hung out in clubs in London, which I didn't go to in those days. And you met up with people who might have a Muddy Waters single or a Little Water EP or something like that. or they had tapes. People like Long John Baldry and those kind of people had various tapes and records which it got from import shops. So it wasn't that I didn't like the blues, it's I didn't know them. I'd never heard it. But when they first introduced me to it, and I was about to play it, I found it quite interesting and I started to make a blues collection.
How did the Stones start moving away from blues, more toward original material and more toward rock and roll?
When Mick and Keith started coming up with good original songs, I think. We were still doing odd cover versions of things, but that was mainly soul music, early soul music and R&B. The likes of Otis Redding before he was well known, Solomon Burke, Sam Cooke, people like that. And then they started writing really good songs and it did become more rock and roll because we were on the road all the time. If we weren't touring America, it was Europe or Australia, England, Scandinavia, and the fans really liked up-tempo music on stage. That's what it really came down to. Whereas in the club's earlier days, you could play very slow songs, it was all right.
The image of the Stones early on was the scruffy, dirty, bad boy band. How much of that was image that was actually planned, and how much of that was just the way you were at the time?
It's totally the way we were, but we weren't scruffy, dirty and smelly and all that, but people just thought we were, because people didn't look like that in those days. They were very well dressed, smart suits, ties, clean shirts. We didn't dress like that. We didn't go on stage with uniforms. It wasn't an important part of the music, we didn't think. The same as other sort of small incidental things, like not smiling when they poked a camera at you. We didn't see why you had to give a big beaming smile when as soon as somebody pointed a lens at you. They were very, very small and unimportant things, but at the time they were thought of as very rebellious and anti-establishment and just being awkward, I suppose.
In the 1960s, when you started touring around the world, you were always really mobbed at concerts by, you know, teenagers who wanted to be near the band and touch the members of the band, or do more than that if they could. Was it ever frightening to be mobbed like that? Were you ever scared?
Oh, there were certain incidences where it was very dangerous, yeah, but you kind of carried it off as a bit of a joke, really. There were panicky moments when you thought cars were going to, you know, the roof of the car was going to come in with people on top of you and all that, and you were suffocated. You couldn't open the windows, and there was faces pressed and bodies against the car in all directions. You couldn't see where the car was going, so you couldn't drive. And you got rescued by the police. There were quite frightening times like that, but it was so over so quickly that it always became a bit of a laugh. And I remember something that's on film from Ireland in 1965, where we're being attacked on stage and all kinds of mayhem going on. And you see at the last moment, one of the guys from the record company trying to drag Brian and Keith away off the stage to escape, and Brian's laughing his head off, and it was a bit like that. We'd go in, jump in the car and drive away, and we'd be absolutely on the floor laughing about what had happened. It was so quick, you know, that you didn't realise the real danger until it was all over.
Brian Jones was one of the main forces behind the Rolling Stones in the first part of the band's life, and then he died in an accident. What have you been able to find out about the cause of his death? How much of it was due to health problems he was suffering? How much of it was because of drugs?
I think it was a combination of all three, actually. I think over the period of the last few years of his life, he was doing a lot of popping all kinds of pills and things. He used to take a lot of downers, you know, sleeping pills and stay awake on them, which makes people very kind of disoriented, a bit like very drunk. And he was drinking quite a lot as well. He'd consume 1-2 bottles of brandy a day and things like that. So the mixture of drugs and alcohol for a start wasn't very good. And then he was taking other drugs, you know, taking dope and but I don't think he ever was involved in heroin or cocaine as far as I remember. Definitely not heroin. And he did have he was very unhealthy. He had a health problem. He had asthma very badly. And I've learned since in researching this book that he had it was quite possible that he had an epileptic problem as well, which the band weren't aware of, and I don't know whether Brian was aware of. And I think the combination of all those caused his death. I think it's quite likely that he suffered an epileptic fit in the swimming pool when he was under the influence of drink and alcohol, and that would explain everything, very simply.
When he died, it was already agreed that he was going to leave the band.
He'd already left.
He'd already left the band. But what impact did it have on the personal lives of everybody in the group to see someone who they'd been close to die?
Well, obviously, it was a great blow to us, and everybody was extremely upset about it. He'd left the band a month before. He was starting to put together the semblances of a new band, and he was very enthusiastic and excited about it. And he was a little bit of a changed person, really. It was the calm before the storm. And then suddenly it happened, you know, when you least expected it. And we were doing a concert at Hyde Park in front of almost 500,000 people 3 days later. And we had the terrible decision of whether to continue with the concert or whether to give it up. We decided to go ahead, but everybody was very upset about it. It's probably why, although the concert was a great event, the band didn't play that wonderfully at the time. You know, it was a bit, I think our thoughts were elsewhere. It was a very sad moment, you know, because we all knew him for years and we still thought of him as a Rolling Stone, really.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, and he's written a new memoir, which is called Stone Alone. This is Fresh Air. Bill Wyman, the bass player for the Rolling Stones, is my guest, and he has a new memoir called Stone Alone. I want to ask you about the Altamont Festival, and this was the festival in 1969 where someone was stabbed to death by one of the Hell's Angels guards at the concert, and the Rolling Stones were performing on stage at the time that the murder took place. I'm wondering what it looked like from your perspective, what you knew was happening in the audience.
It was quite frightening, actually, because it was a situation where we had no control over whatsoever. And the security, as it was Hell's Angels, who were quite vicious and violent with the audience in the front, a bit more violent than they need to have been, and involved in unnecessary beating up of people and things. There was very little you could do. If you stop in those situations, and in riot situations, or any kinds of disturbances, whether they're friendly or not, if you stop playing the music, it tends to get worse, and we've often found that. So we continued to play as much as we possibly could throughout all those disturbances, repeatedly stopping and saying, look, let's call it, let's be good, you know, let's be friends, don't fight, and try to keep the thing going to its end. And this, I remember that guy, Meredith, in a green suit, a black guy in a green suit. He was very near to me where I was standing on the stage. He was about probably eight or 10 feet away from where I was in front of me. And I remember seeing him there on quite a few occasions because he did stand out in the crowd with this bright green suit on. I didn't actually see, I just saw a disturbance in the crowd, as I'd seen many, many disturbances during the concert, of the crowd opening up and Angels going in there flaying people with pool cues and pool sticks. And it was like another one of those disturbances. You'd see dust rising and the crowd open up and something go on, and then it'd cool down again, and it went on and on all the time like that. That's all I can recall of it. And it was getting very late and very dark and cold, and it was just a very bad atmosphere.
During part of the disturbances at Altamont, the Stones were playing Sympathy for the Devil. And I think some people felt that that was, in a way, kind of stirring things up in the crowd, that it was like a bad choice of songs to perform given what was happening. What do you think?
Well, we've performed it ever since on many tours and never had a problem. And those disturbances started from the moment we went on stage. That was just, I think that's, we did all kinds of songs on that show where there were fighting and trouble going. Sympathy for the Devil was just one of the songs we performed. Under My Thumb, it was happening. That's got nothing to do with disturbing people or a disturbing song. I think they've got to look at the film to see what we were actually performing, and that was just one of many songs where there was fighting going on.
Bill Wyman, the bass player for the Rolling Stones, is my guest, and he's written a new memoir called Stone Alone. Do you think it's possible to have a quote, normal life with the kind of money and attention that are lavished on rock stars? I guess what I'm really asking is...
My life is very normal.
I guess I'm not asking so much about you as about, say, a Mick Jagger, who's more of like the star of the band. I don't know, it seems to me at a certain level an almost like ego deformity seems to to set in with a lot of like star performers in every field. And you've been both, you've been an almost like participant observer in a way, do you know what I mean? It's like the quieter
well,
member
the only
of
person,
the band.
The only person in this band that's ever been regarded as a jet setter or a glamour situation like you've been saying is probably Mick, who loves to do that. He loves to be out there with society people and hang out with film stars and jet from one place to the other and go to lavish parties and things. The rest of the band don't do that. You don't get Charlie going to the place like that. Keith doesn't. Keith's very, very gypsy-fied, piratey, you know, and so is Ronnie Wood. Charlie and I are very, very laid-back family men. We don't do those things. You know, I think that's... America's always... focused and a tremendous amount of attention on Mick, and it's the only place in the world where the Stones were ever talked about as Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. It was never like that anywhere else, and it still isn't. It's the Rolling Stones, and yes, Mick is probably the greatest performer that there's been in rock and roll, and he's a wonderful performer, he's a wonderful dancer, he's a great singer, and we're very proud of having him at the front of us. But that's the image that's been given the Stones through Mick's behaviour, not through the rest of the members of the band.
The Steel Wheels tour of was over a year ago. Is that mm-hmm. Do I have a date right? Yeah, it was one of these like zillions of dollars tours that had backing from was it Budweiser who backed the tour?
Yes,
as a commercial sponsor, and I think a lot of people saw this as an example of what rock tours had become, very lavish, expensive productions that had a lot in common with the kind of show business that rock had in its early days rebelled against.
Yes.
And I wonder if you ever think it's gotten too much, you know, too show busy, too expensive, where the music itself kind of gets lost and the values of rock and roll get lost.
But if it's done right, the music doesn't get lost, it just embellishes the music, as it did with our concerts, I believe. The Stones always tried to have, when we went on tour, always tried to have the best stage we could possibly have made, the best lighting, the best sound system. It was always the best attempt, and it cost the most money. And over the years, that's probably why the Stones were never as wealthy as many bands that were riding alongside them at various times in their career, because the Stones spent the majority of their earning money of a tour on the production. And it did become a big production, of course it did, but it had to, because we tried playing small gigs at various times on tours, and we were always criticised because... playing a small theatre in New York, all we got was complaints from all the people that didn't go, saying they couldn't buy tickets because it was too small. Why don't we play a bigger place? So you end up playing the bigger places, and then other people complain, saying they'd like to see us in a small environment. You can't win, really. And with the demand for tickets of over the last 10 or 12 years for the Stones, both in 81 and 89 were the two last big tours, both of them, the only places you could play were big stadiums because of the ticket demands.
You're 53 years old now, is that right?
No, I just turned 54.
54. You know, it's always the Rolling Stones that people point to when they talk about how, you know, rock performers are getting older and the music has gotten older, and people always say, you know, how old can you be and still play rock and roll? I think the Rolling Stones have helped resolve that question, you know, that rock and roll is no longer just a teenage music. And you could probably...
Well, the only reason it was a teenage music in the first place was because the actual format of the music didn't start until the mid-50s in America and a bit later in England, and there was nobody that got old enough to play it older, because you only lived for 2 or 3 years in the business then. So you never had your elder statesman of that music, but you look at all other music, country music, jazz, classical, anything, you've got very old people playing it, because the music's been around a long time, and the people that started have become old. Now the Stones have become old, and we're still playing it, and we're still proving that it can be done at our age. And a lot of very young people resent that for some reason.
The press in America and England have been writing about your marriage to a woman who's 33 years younger than you. Were you concerned when you married her that this would be a big press subject? I mean, is it something you really tried to keep hidden?
No, I read about Picasso, and I realized that Picasso's marriage difference between him and his wife was even greater than mine. So I thought, if he can get away with it, so can I, you know. And he lived to be 94, so he was a good person to look on as an opinion.
How is Ron Wood? He was just hit by a car and broke
both
legs.
Yeah, I heard that yesterday, and I just saw it in the newspapers today. I haven't been in touch with him yet, but apparently he's quite comfortable and much better, and I think he did quite a brave thing, although they said it was a bit foolish of him. He ran out and tried to stop cars from crashing into the car where his wife and his two children were. I thought he was very brave.
Bill Wyman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Wyman is the bass player for the Rolling Stones. His new memoir is called Stone Alone. Next time, singer and AIDS activist Michael Callan. He co-founded the People with AIDS Coalition and the Community Research Initiative. Callan has lived with AIDS for 9 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In Michael Cunningham's new novel, A Home at the End of the World, three characters share a home, a straight woman, and two men, one gay, one not sure. Together they form an unusual family. Coming up, novelist Michael Cunningham on looking for a sense of family in his fiction and his life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Canadian sisters Kate and Anna McGarrigle. It's their first in 7 years. And Robert Altman has a new film called Vincent and Theo. Our film critic Stephen Schiff says it refuses to romanticize the life of Vincent van Gogh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An operation involving 1,000 U.S. Marines, 1,000 airplanes, 16 ships, and Saudi forces is beginning in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Deborah Amos in Saudi Arabia has more on the story.
Imminent Thunder is a six-day exercise, a practice run for what may be a war scenario. This is the third amphibious landing exercise by the Marines since the beginning of the Gulf crisis. The other exercises took place in secrecy further down the Gulf. This one is a high-profile affair on Saudi territory. No live ammunition will be fired, but media coverage ensures that Iraq will get the message when 1,000 Marines and Saudi soldiers land on the beach, backed up by 1,000 aircraft. Iraq has already called the exercise a provocative act because it's being held close to occupied Kuwait. In Dahran, this is Deborah Amos.
In Washington, President Bush has invoked emergency powers, allowing the Pentagon to undertake military construction projects in the Persian Gulf without advance approval from Congress. The president said his action will enable Defense Secretary Cheney to undertake military construction projects that he deems necessary to respond to the threat caused by the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. President Bush has signed the Clean Air Act of 1990, a bill that is designed to cut down on acid rain, urban smog, ozone-depleting chemicals, and toxic pollution. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Environmentalists give President Bush credit for providing the framework for the first revision of the Clean Air Act in more than a decade. Sierra Club President Susan Murrow says the bill is like a breath of fresh air after a 10-year smog alert. At the bill signing ceremony, the president stood with members of Congress who were at each other's throats for months over the measure, which pitted different regions of the country against each other over acid rain. The president said the result marks a new era for clean air.
No American should have to drive out of town to breathe clean air. And every city in America should have clean air.
The bill tightens limits on car emissions, mandates cleaner fuels, and puts strict controls on coal-burning power plants, dry cleaners, bakeries, even backyard barbecues. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
At Cape Canaveral, the space shuttle Atlantis was launched this evening, carrying a classified U.S. military payload. The 100,000-ton shuttle with five astronauts on board was visible 4 miles. Crossed winds had threatened to postpone launch, which NASA said is probably the last secret military mission conducted by a shuttle. A news blackout has been imposed for the 4-day flight. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 15 points to close at 2,545.05, on volume of 153 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Stephen Schiff reviews Robert Altman's new movie about Vincent van Gogh. The Canadian singer-songwriters Kate and Anna McGarrigle have a new album, their first in 7 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker welcomes the return of the McGarrigle sisters. From their album, Heartbeats Accelerating, here's Leave Me Be.
Her dress, it was of snowy white, a rose tied to her wrist. The words her daddy preached to her were softened with a kiss. They'll judge you by your company, they cannot see. Careful who you choose in life and stay where you belong. Leave me be, I'll make my own friends. Don't tell me who to love, don't tell me who to hate. I will find out on my own, don't make the road too narrow.
Kate and Anna McGarrigle are playful misanthropes, capable of a uniquely understated sarcasm and fatalism. They possess a detachment that, 13 years ago on a song called First Born, enabled Kate to look down at her newborn baby and sing, "Some of them make it, some of them don't." And as you just heard, the McGarrigles of the 90s haven't exactly become the McGarrilous. They write songs in which they fantasize about telling people to leave them alone.
Love, love, where can you be? Are you out there looking for me? Love, love, where can you be? Love, I am waiting. Heartbeats accelerating. Will you come when all is still? From the river off the hill. Love, love, where can you be? Love, I am waiting. Heartbeats accelerating.
In a way, it makes good sense for the McGarrigles to release a new album now after all this time. When they put out their first couple of albums in the 70s, they were startling anomalies. In the midst of overwrought L.A. singer-songwriters and frothing punk rockers, here were two women making an austere sort of folk music that was never fussy or self-pitying or merely pretty. Their own albums didn't sell, but critics raved, they developed a devoted cult, and placed songs with a number of other better-known singers. Linda Ronstadt used their tune Heart Like a Wheel as the title song of one of her most popular albums. Still, the late 70s were organized around radio formats and pop cultural political attitudes that had nothing to do with the McGarrigles' eclectic, personal music. Heard now during an aimless, rootless time in popular music, they seem not just welcome, but inevitable. On this album, the McGarrigles have supplemented their usual acoustic guitar and piano with synthesized sounds and electric guitars. Far from being a sellout, it's an enhancement of their meticulously detailed harmonies and lyrics. In the McGarrigles' music, there's a precision that can be mistaken for primness, a reserve that can be interpreted as cold-blooded, a quietness that can strike the uninitiated as timid. And Heartbeats Accelerating is their most accessible album so far. If you really want their heaviest yet most delicate stuff, you should hunt up the 1977 masterpiece Dancer with Bruised Knees. As it is, this new album contains many typical McGarrigle creations, unsentimental writing about the passion and drama of everyday lives and mundane domestic details. The song called I Eat Dinner, for example, is one of the most achingly beautiful descriptions of loneliness that pop music has produced.
I eat dinner at the kitchen table by the light that switches on. I eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger's gone. I eat dinner at the kitchen table and I wash it down with pot. I eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger stops.
If Emily Dickinson teamed up with Joyce Carol Oates to cut a record, it would probably sound like that, don't you think? It's to literature, I think, that you have to look for precedents for this sort of music. Certainly very few musicians have been as tough-minded and yet as vulnerable as Kate and Anna McGarrigle.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Love is a minor chord. Love is a mental chord. Love is a drawn sword. Love is its own war.
This is Fresh Air. took Michael Cunningham 6 years to finish his novel, A Home at the End of the World. Before the novel was completed, a chapter was published in The New Yorker. It brought a flurry of inquiries from publishers. Cunningham signed with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. At the center of this new novel is the relationship between Bobby and Jonathan. They meet in junior high school. The boys become inseparable. Their friendship outlasts their brief sexual relationship. The friendship continues into adulthood when they come together in a non-traditional family.
The impulse to write this book really originated with several friends I've had since I was young. It's not directly autobiographical. There's a group of us rather than just two, and they're men and women both. But we found ourselves in this kind of intense sort of ultra friendship that sort of strained the bonds of ordinary friendly decorum. But at the same time, we weren't, you know, lovers. We weren't going to get married and have children and you know, kind of get in the buckboard together and drive, you know, say goodbye to our families and drive to the next county. I mean, I think we were all sort of looking for a family in each other, and that, in a sense, is what Bobby and Jonathan, the two main characters, are doing. You know, Jonathan is gay and Bobby is straight, and their relationship. I wanted their relationship to be kind of fueled by sex, the way, you know, most relationships of any importance are at some level, but much more about love, finally, than it is about sex.
You know, you say Jonathan's gay and Bobby's straight. I don't think I would have given the same answer having read your book. I'm not so sure Bobby's straight. I'm not sure he knows
what he is. I don't think Bobby knows what he is. No. Bobby sort of hovers above sexuality in a funny way that's particular to him.
See, this is an interesting thing about your novel, because I think a lot of authors now are writing with certainty about one sexual persuasion or another, but your characters are almost in this kind of limbo, at least one of them, maybe two of them, of not quite being sure who they are sexually or what they want sexually.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really sort of dangerous oversimplification for us to think of ourselves and other people in terms of such strict categorizations. One is, you know, being either gay or straight. You know, I think most of us fall somewhere along some kind of spectrum. And I will regret for the rest of my life having said Jonathan is gay and Bobby is straight. That was just a way of getting kind of quickly and flippantly to an idea that actually is antithetical to what I was trying to do in the book. No, these people are many different things and are capable of a lot of conflicting impulses and devotions.
Bobby and Jonathan eventually form what one of them describes as a lopsided family. It's the two men and a woman who Jonathan had been living with, but as what he described as half-lovers. They were very close, but they never had sex. But when Bobby moves in, he and the woman Claire have a sexual relationship as well, and she hopes to have a baby with him. So they have this, you know, quote, lopsided family, and it really works for quite a while. And I think you must have been thinking a lot about alternatives to the traditional family and what they could be, how long they could last.
Oh, sure. That's an idea that's occupied me almost as long as I could remember, as I can't remember, because you know, my family was, and I think I'm quoting one of my characters here. My family was a little bit like the family on Lost in Space, that old television show. You know, my parents had moved far from where they grew up, and we lived together in real isolation. And I think what I know I want, and I think part of what the characters want, is just a bigger family, just a larger group of people to whom you feel some kind of inevitable, unbreakable connection.
Have you found that?
You know, I have, in a way. It's funny. you know, I live in New York, and you know, one of the ways that AIDS has been a real education for me, it's been, I mean, I've seen people take care of each other in ways that you know, 5 years ago, I wouldn't really have imagined people would. I know these two women who took in a friend who was dying, until he and he had planned that he would go back and die with his family, who lived across the country and were drunks and all screwed up in a lot of ways. And this man kind of camped out with these two women who just bought an apartment together, and told them as he got sicker, look, I'll leave to be with my family soon, my kind of awful, screwed up, sad family, because I know you don't want me to die here in this new apartment of yours. And these two women thought about this and talked about it between themselves and, you know, went back to him the next day and said, no, it's all right. If you want to stay here, you can. You can die here. And he did. One of the women called me a few months later and told me that he had died, and I went up there, and I got there before, you know, the cops or any of the other official people who show up, and, you know, we just sat with him. And that... And a lot of other things have made me realize that the one your family, your biological family, is very important. But the old one about how when the chips are down, all you have is your family, isn't so true. You really can make other connections. I think I probably feel more optimistic than the book may let on.
When we were talking about the sexuality of the characters in your book and whether they're straight or gay or whether they know and how people are often just, you know, somewheres within a larger spectrum of feelings. Were you working out your own feelings when you were writing the novel, trying to think of where you fit within the spectrum?
Oh, sure. That's always been, it's been a problem for me for a long time.
What was the problem?
Well, I was involved with women for years. Several women who I loved a great deal. You know, and I wasn't just trying to prove something. I wasn't just sort of getting through it as best I could. I really love these women, but about 10 years ago, I met a man who I, you know, I found that I loved at least as much as I'd love these women I'd been involved with, you know, and I found that where I had thought of myself as straight, you know, and certainly imagined that I would get married and have kids. No, in fact, kind of by definition, suddenly I was gay, and I don't know if either term ever ever fit especially comfortably, being perceived as straight when I was with a woman, or as gay when I was with a man. Both felt like cases of mistaken identity. I live with a man now, Ken Corbett. He's a psychologist, and we're very happy. So by some kind of clinical definition, that makes me gay. But it still seems a real oversimplification and a way of kind of dismissing and ghettoizing what's in fact a highly complicated, contradictory, and very individual thing, sexuality. And I think that's true of people who are labeled straight as well as people who are labeled gay.
Well, Michael Cunningham, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Cunningham's new novel is A Home at the End of the World. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. A conventional forces reduction agreement has been reached in Vienna between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Senate is holding hearings into the activities of the so-called Keating Five. We'll talk with Brett Easton Ellis, the author of American Psycho, a Simon & Schuster book set for January publication. The book has now been canceled by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Ellis defends his writing, saying it does not advocate sexual violence. And we'll talk with Julie Gold, singer and songwriter, about her song, From a Distance. It's a big song in the British Isles, and now it's a number one song in this country for Bette Midler.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, Vincent and Theo, is based on the lives of Vincent van Gogh and his brother. It's directed by Robert Altman, whose films include McCabe and Mrs. Miller, MASH, and Nashville. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Vincent and Theo begins in a way that seems all too inevitable. The recent auction of Vincent van Gogh's painting Sunflowers at Christie's for $40 million. But as we hear the price go up and up and up, the scene shifts back a century to van Gogh's garret, where Vincent, played by Tim Roth, is lying on a bed biting on his pipe. You can see that his teeth are rotten and that his eyes are on fire. And the way he bites that pipe is so full of tension and resentment and violence that you know immediately that this isn't going to be the saintly moondog Vincent celebrated in the Don McLean song. This is Van Gogh the misfit, pitiable maybe, but also intolerable, venomous, so consumed with himself and his art that he can neither love nor receive love. A genius, yes, but a horrifying one. The story of doomed Vincent and his loyal brother Theo is a familiar one, but Robert Altman, in his best film since the 70s, makes it gripping all over again. He takes us inside the labyrinth of Van Gogh's madness, and what we find at the center is a kind of sacred monster, a crazed painting machine, too intense to do anything except create art and destroy himself. His brother, the art dealer Theo, played by Paul Rees, loves him without liking him, and you can hear what he has to put up with in scenes like this one, in which Vincent moves into Theo's Paris apartment.
I want to know what's been going on here when I've been away.
Look, what is the point of Paris? What is the whole point of Paris? It's to talk to people, it's to meet people, it's to talk to other artists.
I think you'd better go to bed. And don't you tell me there's no market for my work! It's your job to make a market! If you can sell Toro, you can damn well sell me!
For Theo, Vincent is like a demiurge, a kind of holy Mr. Hyde to his Dr. Jekyll. Theo can feel Vincent inside him. Vincent is the part that he knows is great, but also the part that drags him down, way beneath the bourgeois respectability he aspires to. In some ways, the movie reminds me of David Cronenberg's eerie Dead Ringers. It's about the dangerous and inexplicable bonds of brotherhood. But it's about a lot more besides. Subtly and without pushing, Altman brings you inside Vincent's way of seeing, and the movie's very texture bumps you along between agony and ecstasy. There's gorgeous cinematography by Jean Lepine, and a terrifying, weirdly appropriate modern score by Gabriel Yared. As Theo, Paul Reiss spends a lot of time twitching when he ought to be acting. But the rest of the cast is very fine, especially Tim Roth, who gives a tortured, fearless performance as Van Gogh, and Vladimir Yordanov, who's all graceful arrogance as Gauguin. It almost goes without saying that since this is a movie about an artist and an art dealer, it is also a movie about the contentious brotherhood of art and commerce. But what Altman gets at is the way that contention seeps into an artist's soul. What happens to a painting machine whose paintings no one wants to buy or even see? What happens when he's forced to believe in himself as arbitrarily as he believes in love or God, without confirmation, without a shred of proof? This is a dark, gorgeous, difficult movie, and a brave one. Altman has taken one of our weariest, most worn-out artistic myths, the story of poor Vincent van Gogh, and he's breathed it hellishly back to life.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Sherrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Michael Callan, one of the co-founders of People with AIDS Coalition and the Community Research Initiative. It's a grassroots movement to test new AIDS-related drugs. Also, James Welch on his new novel, The Indian Lawyer, and the difficulty of remaining Indian in a non-Indian world. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.